Whole, Parts, and Holy Parts was presented by David Crabtree on October 24, 2004, at the 2004 Oktoberfest conference titled An Anniversary Medley. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle. This is the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side.
The title of my talk is Whole Parts and Holy Parts. I thought of that myself. I'm hoping that by the end of the talk, you'll know why I named it that. It actually does have meaning. I've been thinking about organization for a number of years now, partly as a result of the organizational changes that we have to go through in Gutenberg. We've had to think about how to organize ourselves more formally in a way that will be enduring. We've had to talk to other colleges to see how they're organized. In addition to that, I've been a part of other organizations along the way. I've thought a lot about it, and I've seen organizations from the outside. Furthermore, in the curriculum at Gutenberg College, we have read a number of books about that have to do with organization. Usually it's social and political organization, but nevertheless it's organization. This last year, I served as an advisor for Colin Stetter, and he did some work on Marxism and Alexander Solzhenitsyn's criticisms of the Soviet state, which is a mammoth organization. So I've looked at a lot of different organizations, thought about organizations, and looked at them from different perspectives. And I have found it intriguing in thinking about the issues involved. When I'm talking about organization, I'm speaking in the broadest sense possible. All I mean is people coming together and working cooperatively towards a common goal. There are big organizations, there are small organizations. Big going to the size of a nation, there are small going to the size of even a family. They can be temporary, lasting only a very short time, or they can be long-term, designed to endure for centuries. They can be formally organized with a real structure, or they can be absolutely informal, just people on an ad hoc basis coming together and working together. So the definition that I'm using is really wide, and that's the way I intend it. I think as human beings, coming together and working cooperatively is part of our nature. I think it has always been the case that human beings have organized, and it always will be the case. Why? First of all, because we're social beings. We like to come together and interact one with another. I have found it interesting over the years in reading about people who have been in prison camps or concentration camps. The uniform testimony of people who have been in that kind of setting is that the worst punishment one can have is to be isolated from other human beings. That deprived of any contact with other human beings, it's very difficult to maintain one's sanity. I take their testimony to be true, that we really do need one another. That's just built into us. So organization comes naturally. We want to come together and even want to seek out excuses to be together. Secondly, more can be accomplished if we work together cooperatively. My wife and I were building a shed. It started out as a potting shed, and I'm not sure what kind of a shed it is now. But we started working on it earlier this summer, and we were putting shingles on the roof. And working on it by myself, I made very, very slow progress. You climb up the ladder, you put the shingle on, you climb down the ladder, you cut another shingle, then you climb up the ladder, and you put on the next shingle. Very time consuming. When my wife and I worked together, we went more than twice as fast as I was progressing by myself. We've all seen that phenomenon, and it happens all the time, that coming together you can accomplish more than you could have accomplished separately, so it's more efficient. Furthermore, you can take advantage of people's various talents. Some people are more skilled at going up the ladder than others. Some people are more skilled at cutting the shingles at the right angle, etc. So you can take advantage of those various talents that are out there. And the third thing, which is not insignificant, at least in my mind, is there's something really satisfying about working together. Some of my most satisfying experiences growing up were being on teams, sports teams, in which the whole was far greater than the sum of the parts. That is, you take a bunch of mediocre talents, of which I was one, you bring a bunch of mediocre talents together, and there's something really satisfying about seeing that team outperform a team that has more talented individuals. There's something really satisfying about that. And I think that's another impetus for organization. Now, organizations come and go. I think that will always be the case. Some are intended to be short-lived. They only come together for a short period of time and then disband. Others fall apart because it's difficult for us as human beings to work together. It's just the nature of us as sinful beings that as we are pulled together in a common enterprise, that our weaknesses begin to undermine that enterprise. Grievances accumulate for everyone, some of them real, some of them imagined, but over time the general tendency is that organizations fall apart. Only a few survive. I was interested in, this is kind of a digression, but I was talking to someone this summer who was telling me about a college that was being formed on the East Coast. And they'd been working on it for 2 years. It was well-funded. They had a good staff. And they had made good progress in putting together this college. But before they could open the doors, the project was abandoned because of interpersonal difficulties that it undermined it. And that's a very common phenomenon. It's very interesting. We take for granted the grace of God that allows us to work together cooperatively over a long period of time. But we will keep forming organizations as part of human nature, and we will, despite the frustrations, I'm sure that will continue to be a part of human existence. Now, here is the issue that interests me, and I'm going to let's do a little mind experiment. The issue is the relative value. How do you deal with the competing interests of the organization as opposed to the individuals that make up that organization? How do you balance those competing interests when they come into conflict? Take this example. Say that we are in warfare. We are a military force here, and you are the commander. And we are in a situation in which we need to retreat. The enemy is at our doorstep. But in order for us to be able to retreat, some few are going to have to be selected to hold off the enemy while the rest retreat. Who are you going to assign that duty to? On what basis? On what right? And who will you select? And why? I've never been in warfare. I don't choose to be in warfare. But I've often thought about that kind of scenario, being a commander of a military force and having to make that kind of decision, and I would agonize over it. How would you make that kind of choice? Now, fortunately, we rarely face situations of that magnitude in organizations, but we do face the problem at a lower, with less at stake, possibly, but we face the same problem all the time. That is, there's always someone that's going to have to make sacrifices for the good of the whole. When you take your vacation, when you go on a coffee break, who stays late to work on stuff that needs to be done. Those kinds of things happen all the time, and I'm sure you're all very familiar with it. But that's the individual is having to sacrifice for the good of the whole. And how do we balance those two? How do we think about that? I'm not going to answer the question that I've posed. I'll warn you that now. But I think that there's some things that I'd like to talk about that can help put it into perspective. And in particular, I have noticed in the reading that I have done that people often liken an organization to a body. A body is made up of many different parts, but they're all coordinated working towards the same common goal. And body becomes the metaphor then that people often use when they are referring to organization. Thomas Hobbes in Leviathan uses the metaphor of the body as being analogous to the commonwealth, the state. The Apostle Paul in the New Testament also uses the metaphor of the body to talk about the church, the body of Christ. But in looking at those two uses of that same metaphor, it seems to me that they are using the metaphors very differently. And how they are using them differently, I think, is significant and can help us to see to have two different perspectives on organization and how to think about organization. So what I'm going to do is go through briefly and talk about Thomas Hobbes and what he is arguing in Leviathan. And then I want to look at a passage in the New Testament and see what the Apostle Paul is doing with that same metaphor. And then talk about the significance of the different ways that they're using the metaphor. Thomas Hobbes was an Englishman, lived in England in the 17th century, which was a very tumultuous time. That was the time of the Civil War that happened in England. And as a result of that Civil War, there was a Civil War that developed when the Parliament refused to grant to the king the right to raise taxes. And he wanted to raise taxes so he could conduct a war in Scotland. Parliament refused to raise taxes. And as a result, Charles I said, well, then I will operate in independence from the Parliament. And Parliament said, I beg your pardon. And there was a civil war that broke out. And Charles I ended up being arrested. And then he was ultimately beheaded. And he was beheaded with the charge of treason against the state, which at the time made no sense. Because at the time, the perspective was that the king is the state. The country is his. The people are his subjects. They are there for him to do with as he pleases. How could the king commit treason against the state? That's a non sequitur for most people at the time. Nevertheless, Parliament executed him on the basis of treason against the state. What followed then was a period of civil war and social and civic unrest. It was very tumultuous for a couple of decades. And there was no stability in England for that period of time. So Hobbes, as an observer of all of this, He wants to find a basis for stability. Everything's been thrown up in the air. The foundations have been destroyed. The foundations for the state have been destroyed. So he wants to figure out how can we reestablish a firm foundation on which the state can be built. And he's living in the time of in the early decades of the period that we call the Enlightenment. So he did what enlightened people do. That is, he sat back in his chair and he thought about it. On the basis of reason, he was going to figure out what is the foundation for the state. And he took as inspiration for his project Euclid. Euclid was the Greek who in centuries earlier had put together geometry, an understanding of geometry, starting with just a handful of assumptions. He was able to prove tens of propositions that had to follow from those assumptions. And so what he was able to do is start with just a handful of assumptions and prove a lot of things. And all of those things were beyond doubt. They had to be true. They were as true as logic itself. And in the Renaissance and in the Enlightenment, what Euclid did with geometry became an inspiration for all thinkers. All thinkers said, oh, if I could only do in my field what Euclid did in geometry. So Hobbes is thinking, if I can only do in political science what Euclid did in geometry. So he starts out with a few assumptions and then builds this system. I will not go through the whole system, but just let me summarize what he comes up with. He concludes that mankind in his natural state is greedy and aggressive. If you take a bunch of human beings and put them on a desert isle, they're going to beat up on each other. They're going to steal from each other. They're going to try to accumulate both wealth and power for themselves. It's natural. It's going to happen. He says, I put for a general inclination of all mankind a perpetual and restless desire of power after power that ceaseth only in death. So that's the kind of person that man is. That's the kind of being he is. And the problem is, men are all essentially equal. There is no one human being who can dominate all the rest. If that were the case, there wouldn't be as much conflict. He'd just bop a few people on the head, and then everything would be fine. But that is not the case. We're all more or less equal. And as a result, there is no one person who's so strong that two or three others can't beat up on him. As a result, there's going to be constant conflict. So he calls this the state of war. Man in his natural state is going to be constantly in this conflict. And even those who would like to stay out of the conflict, those who are not particularly aggressive and greedy, they're going to see that if they just sit back, somebody's going to come and beat up on them. So everyone is going to act preemptively. You're going to try to figure out some way to strike before you are attacked. He says, here it is manifest that during the time men live without a common power to keep them all in awe, they are in that condition which is called war, and such a war as is of every man against every man. And this is an intolerable situation. Because in this situation, you cannot have science. You cannot have culture. You cannot have education and learning. He says, Whatsoever therefore is consequent to a time of war, where every man is enemy to every man, the same is consequent to the time wherein men live without other security than what their own strength and their own invention shall furnish them withal. In such condition there is no place for industry, because the fruit thereof is uncertain, and consequently no culture of the earth, no navigation, nor use of the commodities that may be imported by sea, no commodious building, no instruments of moving and removing such things as require much force, no knowledge of the face of the earth, no account of time, no arts, no letters, no society, and which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death. And then the line that's most famous from his book, and the life of man, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. So apart from the state, that's what he sees as the condition of man. And that is intolerable. So, the formation of the state is absolutely critical. That has to happen from Hobbes' perspective. He says, the final cause, end, or design of men in that introduction of restraint upon themselves is the foresight of their own preservation and of a more contented life thereby. That is to say, of getting themselves out from that miserable condition of war, which is necessarily consequent to the natural passions of men. Okay, so the question is, how do we bring this about? It has to happen. How do we bring about this state that's so important, that makes civilization possible? Excuse me. He says it can't come from natural desires. There are certain natural desires that push us in that direction, but they are overwhelmed by our desires to be greedy and aggressive. Our propensity of war is too great, and so the Commonwealth can't come out of just natural desires. Well, how about from families? Maybe families, that war doesn't exist in families. Maybe that principle of unity that is within families, that can just be expanded and you can develop the Commonwealth. And what he argues is the ties that hold family together diminish as it grows. So the ties that make a family possible, those are not adequate for a state, to be ties that hold people together in a state. Furthermore, just a large group of people cannot form into a state in and of themselves because they are not committed to one leader. There's no unity there. So how does the state come to be? And here's what he posits. It has to be the case that what happens is a group of people come together and they swear an oath. Whether they do so formally or informally, this has to be what happens. They swear an oath in which they grant all power and authority to a sovereign, whether that be one person or a group of people, an assembly. But they all swear their complete allegiance to that sovereign in exchange for everyone else in the state making the similar commitment, the same commitment. Here's the way he states it. This is the nature of the promise that everyone makes in a state. I authorize and give up my right of governing myself to this man or to this assembly of men on this condition, that thou give up thy right to him and authorize all his actions in like manner. So everybody in a state, they're saying, sovereign, we give you complete authority, and everyone is making that same pledge, and that's what makes the state possible. So what's happening is everyone gives up their right to do as they please, and they give the sovereign the authority over them, the authority to rule. And that's the state as he's envisioning it. Now Hobbes likens this entity then to a body. And the sovereign is the head. And all the members of the state are like parts of the body. He says, this done, that is everyone making this pledge, this done, the multitude so united in one person is called a commonwealth, in Latin, civitas. This is the generation of that great Leviathan, or rather, to speak more reverently, of that mortal God to which we owe under the immortal God our peace and defense. For by this authority given him by every particular man in the commonwealth, he hath the use of so much power and strength conferred on him, that by terror thereof he is enabled to form the wills of them all to peace at home and mutual aid against their enemies abroad. And in him consisteth the essence of the commonwealth, which to define it is one person, of whose acts a great multitude by mutual covenants one with another have made themselves every one the author, to the end he may use the strength and means of them all, as he shall think expedient for their peace and common defense. I think it's very curious that he refers to this body, this state, this commonwealth that comes into being as a Leviathan. Hobbes is writing in a time when English culture was immersed in Scripture. They were all very, very familiar with the Bible. And in particular, the King James Bible. And Leviathan is a term that is used in the Bible. It shows up about four times in the Old Testament. In particular, it shows up in Job and in Psalms. And in both of those contexts, in Psalms and in Job, where it shows up, it's not clear what beast Leviathan refers to, and that's why it's basically transliterated in the King James. Some people say it's a crocodile, some people say it's some other beast, but it's in both contexts, in Job and Psalms, it is used to show that God is in control of all of creation. And it's pointing out that God even easily handles Leviathan. If God can easily handle Leviathan, then clearly he's in control of creation. That's essentially the context in which it's used. So Leviathan then, whatever it is, it stands for that being which is second in power only to God. So I think that's why Hobbes has used Leviathan as his term for the state. He also refers to it as that mortal God. So it almost reaches the status of divinity, except for the fact that it's mortal. The state will pass away. But it's the biggest, baddest thing that exists within creation. And that's why he uses the term Leviathan. So in sum then, what he envisions in the state is a whole nation of people who are conducting themselves in lockstep according to the will of the sovereign. The sovereign is, the Leviathan is so great that no one dare challenge its authority. The Leviathan would just crush him. And that's the way peace and order is established and maintained that makes civilization possible. So for him, the body is a symbol of this, of a lot of parts working in perfect coordination according to the will of the sovereign. It's like a well-oiled machine. And if you can have a well-oiled machine working according to one will, imagine what can be accomplished. There's a lot of power that can be brought to bear with such an entity. Okay, so that's how he's using the metaphor of the body. Let's look at what Paul does with it. And I think it's very different. And I think that's quite intriguing. Let me read. This is a long passage, so bear with me, and we won't have time to actually talk about the passage. It's a passage in 1 Corinthians 12, verses 12 through the end of the chapter. I'm just going to read through it, and what I would like you to do is pay attention to how he is using the metaphor of the body. What is he using the body to symbolize? Verse 12 of 1 Corinthians 12. For even as the body is one and yet has many members, and all the members of the body, though they are many, are one body, so also is Christ. For by one Spirit we were all baptized into one body, whether Jews or Greeks, whether slaves or free, and we were all made to drink of one Spirit. For the body is not one member, but many. If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I am not a part of the body, it is not for this reason any less a part of the body. And if the ear should say, because I am not an eye, I am not a part of the body, it is not for this reason any the less a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would hearing be? If the whole were hearing, where would the sense of smell be? But now God has placed the members, each one of them, in the body just as he desired. And if they were all one member, where would the body be? But now there are many members, but one body. And the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you. Or again the head to the feet, I have no need of you. On the contrary, it is much truer that the members of the body which seem to be weaker are necessary. And those members of the body which we deem less honorable, on these we bestow more abundant honor, and our unseemly members come to have more abundant seemliness, whereas our seemly members have no need of it. But God has so composed the body, giving more abundant honor to that member which lacked, that there should be no division in the body, but that the members should have the same care for one another. And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. If one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. Now you are Christ's body, and individually members of it. And God has appointed in the church first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, then miracles, then gifts of healing, helps, administrations, various kinds of tongues. All are not apostles, are they? All are not prophets, are they? All are not teachers, are they? All are not workers of miracles, are they? All do not have gifts of healing, do they? All do not speak with tongues, do they? All do not interpret, do they? But earnestly desire the greater gifts. Paul is assuming in this passage that there is a fundamental unity among believers. As believers, there is something that we share in common that is at such a basic level, it creates a oneness that is just inherently there in the choice of becoming a believer. That is, we all have a common mission. We're all headed in the same direction. And that is a kind of unity that supersedes any other kind of unity that could exist among mankind. He's assuming that kind of unity. That exists. That is a given. And he uses the metaphor of the body as something that is so unified that the parts can't think of themselves as being separate from the body. If my hand hurts, then it's my hand that hurts. I can't distance myself from it and say, oh, I'm sorry you hurt, hand. We can't do that. It's the whole body that's in pain. The whole body suffers. That kind of unity simply exists among believers. And it's on the basis of our commitment of faith and our common mission then. So his point in using the metaphor of the body is, we're all parts of this unity, so every part, regardless of its function, is worthy. Every part is a legitimate part of the body just by virtue of being a body part. It's worthy because it's a part of the body. So in a body, the welfare of each part is a concern of the whole. That's the nature of the case. He uses this metaphor also in Ephesians 4, 12 through 16. I won't even take the time to read it, but the point that he makes there is that we have an obligation to other believers to lovingly encourage, instruct, to edify each other and encourage them in the path of righteousness, to develop in their understanding of the faith. So the picture that he has is the church is a body in the sense that it has a single mission. The whole thing is moving in the same direction. It has a fundamental unity that's undeniable by virtue of everyone's decision in faith. And with that comes a responsibility of helping one another to grow in faith. Any other mission is secondary. So if we compare the two views of organization then, Hobbes is thinking, you know, if what we need is power. If power existed, peace and civilization could be created. But in order to get power, we need to bring about, we need to create unity. And how are we going to do that? And that's the problem. How do we create this unity? So from Hobbes' perspective, the thing that is lacking is that unity, some basis for unity. And he comes up with this pledge that we all make, and then once that pledge is made and we form the state, then the sovereign makes sure that everyone walks in lockstep. So we achieve unity by force. We force everyone to be in their position in the body. It doesn't have to be force. I think, well, I'll talk about that in just a second. I think it's curious because behind what he's doing is essentially a lust for power. If only we could all band together, imagine what we could do. And it's very reminiscent of the story of the Tower of Babel, in which it was the same kind of lust for power. If we could just stick together, if we could just hold this society together, imagine what we could accomplish. For Paul, on the other hand, unity is simply a reality. At the most fundamental level, we are one. We are all unified. That's the case. We don't have to create unity. It is a fact. It's a fact that springs out of the decision that we have made. In his presentations, there's no hint of lusting after power. There's no interest in talking about what we could accomplish if we all worked together. That doesn't come into his thinking whatsoever. His interest is, if we are unified, then we have an obligation one to another. If we are unified, then, and we're all headed in the same direction, it is our job to help one another on that journey of learning what it means to be people of faith. Okay, what is the significance then of the two different ways that they're using this metaphor? Hobbes wants to create a unity in order to harness the power of the collective. That's been the dream of mankind for centuries, millennia. And the problem is there's no fundamental enduring unity. So it has to be created. It has to be fabricated. It has to be imposed in some way. In his model, it's created by force. Everyone's forced to play their role in the body. But it doesn't have to be forced. It can be done by reward, pay, privileges. Or people can be manipulated into playing their role in the whole. in the life of the larger organization. But whenever this is the case, whenever it's true that the organization exists, has to create this unity and exists in order to achieve its organizational mission, there will be an inversion. That is, organizations always come into being in order to serve, to benefit people. All organizations in some way exist to benefit people. But apart from a fundamental unity and what I will call a meta-mission, and I'll talk about that in just a second, it will always be inverted in such a way that the organization comes to serve its organizational mission at the cost of the welfare of the individual members. It will always sacrifice the individual to the larger whole. Hobbes is aware of this. In his discussion, he realizes that in order to achieve a peaceful commonwealth, each person has to sacrifice all their freedom, with the result that the individual escapes the condition of war by placing himself at the mercy of Leviathan. He escapes from one kind of insecurity to another. And he has a brief discussion where he talks about, well, what if Leviathan, the state, were to pick on the individual? Could Leviathan command an individual to kill himself? He says, no, then it's stepping over its bounds. Because remember, this whole thing was formed in order to preserve unity, preserve liberty. But if Leviathan should send someone to kill you, you have no choice but to die nobly. In other words, the mission of the organization trumps the mission of the individual. The individual is sacrificed to the mission of the organization. And I think that we see this over and over again, that organizations come into being with very noble objectives and goals, but apart from what I'll talk about in just a second, what I call a meta-mission, the mission of the organization comes to dominate and take precedence over the interests of the individuals involved. One of the most interesting examples of that, I think, is attempts to bring about socialistic states, the Soviet Union, and other communist countries. The goal of those states was always to create a more equitable and humane society in which individuals would benefit. But history shows us that in each case, what happens is the welfare of the whole takes precedence over the individuals. And that's one of the insights, I think, of Solzhenitsyn as well as Dostoevsky. In Solzhenitsyn, in the Cancer Ward, points out that he has one character as this communist official, a high-ranking official within the Soviet Union. And he gets cancer and is put into this room in the cancer ward with I think, four other individuals. And one of the comments, one of the observations of one of the other patients in that cancer ward is that this high-ranking official, he loves the masses. He just doesn't like people. So the mission is serving this abstraction rather than real live people. The mission of the organization, of society, serves society as a whole, this abstraction, rather than real live individuals. But Paul's metaphor, I think, gives us a way out. It offers help. In Paul's metaphor, the goal is not power. And unity is a fact. It doesn't have to be created. In other words, what he's doing is urging us to remember that each individual is holy. Each part within the whole is holy and is worthy of our attention and concern. So within the body, the church, the church can never have a higher mission than the spiritual growth and development of individuals. There can be no higher mission. So whatever the immediate task at hand might be, as we think about the church, we often think of churches like this one, of groups of believers that are gathered together for specific purposes, maybe, like for Bible study or youth groups or even banding together to fight drug use or something like that. Whatever the immediate task at hand, that mission of that organization will be subservient to the more fundamental mission, and that is the growth and development of each individual. The mission of any specific organization should never trump the mission of each individual. So what happens in the body of believers? It's believers coming together in various forms, whatever they are, whatever brings them together, in order to carry out their most fundamental mission. And what is that most fundamental mission? It is encouraging one another to grow in faith and an understanding of the truth. Whatever we might need to do to help foster that, that's what we are to do as believers. So whatever it brings us together, let's say we come together in order to build a house for someone. As a group of believers, we come together to build a house for someone. Building the house is just an excuse for us to be together. Building a house is just an excuse for us to interact in ways that can be beneficial to one another. So the construction of the house has to be secondary to the primary focus. It's just an excuse for us to be iron sharpening iron. And that process can look messy. There are all kinds of things that happen in interpersonal relations. That's fine. The goal is to continually be edifying one to another, however, whatever shape that takes. If it looks messy, it looks messy. It's going to be messy. That's fine. We don't have something in this world that we're trying to accomplish. We're looking elsewhere. We've got more long-range goals that we're thinking about. Okay. As I promised, I have not answered the question that I posed originally. The question of what does this military commander do in his situation? I'm convinced that when we face those dilemmas, there is no easy calculus that you can plug into the machine and it cranks out the answer, what you do. The conflict of interests between the whole and the parts is very complicated, and each situation has to be addressed on a case-by-case basis on its own merit. But the principle with respect to the church, I think, has wider application and extends beyond the church and beyond organizations of believers. I think by implication we have an obligation to all of mankind, because who knows the destiny of those that are standing next to us? It seems to me that for a believer, in association with other people, whether they're believers or not non-believers, the meta mission, the more important mission, can never be set aside. We always have an obligation to our fellow human man being to encourage them towards faith and understanding of the truth. We always have a higher agenda. And the organizational mission always has to take a back seat. Organizational missions are never of eternal significance. The only thing that I have control over that is of eternal significance is the decision that I make with respect to God in my heart. And the next closest thing that I have to doing something of eternal significance is the way that I treat the people that are around me. I don't cause them to come to the belief, but I can influence their decisions toward with respect to eternity. I have quoted this passage in times past, but it is one of my favorite passages from C.S. Lewis. This is from The Weight of Glory, and I can't help but quote it again. And he's talking about how we interact with those who are around us. It is a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses, to remember that the dullest and most uninteresting person you talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship, or else a horror and a corruption such as you now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare. All day long, we are, in some degree, helping each other to one or other of these destinations. It is in the light of these overwhelming possibilities, it is with the awe and the circumspection proper to them, that we should conduct all our dealings with one another, all friendships, all loves, all play, all politics. There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. Every organization, whether it's an organization of believers or an organization of non-believers, it is made up of individuals that are made in the image of God. And for this reason, each individual must be treated with respect and in love. In this sense, then, in any organization, the parts are holy. And if the parts are holy, they need to be treated as such. Usually when I can't answer questions is because I don't know the answer. This time I have an added complication. I can't talk. Are there questions?
When Paul speaks of the church, is he speaking there of the universal Catholic with a small C church? Or is he speaking and were your marks referencing local believers or both?
Well, there is a fundamental unity that is shared among all believers. And I think that's primarily what he has in mind when he talks about the body. So he's talking about people who have this fundamental unity that pulls them all together, that makes them one. Whether they're organizationally one or not, he's really not dealing with that issue. They are one. They share a common destiny, a common mission. That has implications, however, for us as we come together in groups. And that is that we have an obligation in whatever forums we come together, whether it's formal organizations like in a church like this, or whether it's just meeting together over dinner. We have come together in a forum, and we have an obligation to those other believers. And that obligation is to be edifying in their lives, to further their development in faith and understanding. In whatever form that takes, it can be to be encouraging, or it can be to be admonishing. It can be that can take a lot of different forms depending on the situation.
Then if it's not an organizational unity.
A formal organization.
How would you characterize a unity? Would you use the term mystical or...
Well, the definition that I used for an organization was people working cooperatively towards a common goal. As believers, we have a common goal. That is, we are committed to becoming righteous and to being loving towards our fellow man. So we have a common commission, a common mission that we are obligated to be working towards. So there's a unity there that just comes out of doing the same, being headed in the same direction, and having a commitment one to another. So is it? It's a mystical, if you want to call it that. Yes, it's a mystical unity.
I believe you said that the primary objective of the church is to is for mutual encouragement. Was that what you were getting at?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's any other primary objective at the core of the idea of the church that would be, is there any other like primary objective, any other general mission?
Well, encouragement in the sense of encouraging people, encouraging our fellow believers to become more faithful and to understand the truth. No, I don't think there's a more fundamental mission.
As you just said, in helping people to understand truth, that can generate a lot of conflict at times.
Yes.
Can you talk about a good way to do that, to help people understand truth?
Well, we are human beings, and as human beings, we have our sets of weaknesses and foibles. That's just the way it is. And you bring us together, and even though we have a fundamental unity, unquestionably, there are going to be fissures that develop because that we are sinful people. As we try to come to an understanding of truth, there's going to be disagreements. Some of those disagreements will be... My observation is that, in generally speaking, in disagreements, there are complicating factors. Part of it is purely intellectual, but part of it is interpersonal, and there are other factors that all come into play. Part of what it means to grow in faith is to work through the issues that arise as we're in conflict. We have a fundamental unity. We are all committed to the truth. As Jack was talking about last night, we should be able, of all people, we should be the best equipped to be able to address issues of disagreement in a way that is respectful and constructive rather than destructive. And learning how to do that is edifying. That's a good thing for us to learn how to do. And we learn how to do it by trying it and failing and making adjustments. Being a part of the body is, like I mentioned before, it really is messy. But there's nothing wrong with messiness. God created the world out of chaos. He's certainly able to create faith and goodness out of the chaos of our lives and our interpersonal relationships. One of the things that has been very interesting to me with respect to Gutenberg is when we first got started, I guess I thought that peace and harmony in the classroom was critical for having a learning environment. I have since changed my mind. That there is something that's actually very beneficial about the natural kind of tension and stresses that develop, the interpersonal problems that arise, and that helping students to see their way through those things is one of the most educational things we can do. So I no longer am as adverse to messiness as I used to be. So much good comes out of it. God's a very clever creator, and he's able to create order even out of chaos and messiness. Okay, thanks.